Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director here at the Institute, and it's my pleasure to be hosting David Rothkopf for today's discussion of US foreign policy after President Barack Obama and other topics. About a year ago, I wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times on this topic, and I compared it to the story of Goldilocks. And I said, as everyone knows, Goldilocks went for a walk in the forest. She came to the home of the three bears, and she found three bowls of porridge. And the first bowl was too hot, and the second bowl was too cold, but the third one was just right. And in a sense, it seemed to me that mirrored the world's reaction to the last few presidents. We found President Bush too hot, too impulsive, too promiscuous, too forward-leaning in his use of force, but we've found President Obama too cold, too cautious, too calculating, too reserved. And I argued that what the world needs now is a foreign policy that's just right. And if only we had a candidate with blonde locks who could come up with such a policy, things would be much better. Since I wrote that piece, Obama has roared back in a way. He's had some big wins on the foreign policy front with the Iran nuclear deal, the relationship with Cuba and other issues. And domestically, too, Obamacare was upheld by the Supreme Court. We had the landmark decision on marriage equality. He got approval from the Congress in relation to fast track for the TPA. So one of the questions I want to explore with David is whether Obama has now given us a foreign policy that's just right. Has Obama warmed up to the extent that this is the kind of foreign policy that the United States needs, or rather, should we be looking to the next bowl of porridge? To discuss these issues, David, we're very lucky indeed to have David Rothkopf with us. He is one of the most influential foreign policy analysts in Washington. In his role as CEO and editor of the FP Group, he oversees all the editorial publishing events and operations of the company, which oversees the storied foreign policy, publishes the storied foreign policy magazine, and FP.com, which many of us view on a daily basis. He writes regularly for the New York Times, the Post, the Financial Times, and many others. He's the author of several books. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was a senior legislative aide to a well-known US congressman, Stephen Solars, as well as an official in the Clinton administration. So he's really a perfect person to talk to us. So, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming David Rothkopf. David and I will talk for about half an hour, and then we'll take questions for the same period. So please get your questions ready. David, let's start where I finished, with Obama. Has he got it just right now? How do you think his presidency is shaping up?
Well, first, let me thank you for having me here. It's a great pleasure to be in Sydney. And having said that, let me turn on you immediately and say I'm very devastated to hear your story about this Financial Times op-ed, which I now recall, because I've been stealing this story and using it as my own for quite some time. In fact, my mother called me a couple months ago and said, how can I possibly prepare myself to understand the election of 2016? And I said, well, I have a book for you to read. And she said, oh, no, I've read your book already. Not again. And I said, no, not my book. I said Goldilocks and the Three Bears for exactly the reason that you've brought it up. And I thought I was pretty clever. And I now realize that I was just plagiarizing. So I apologize for that. But I think you've got it right. I do think that the story of the past 15 years in U.S. foreign policy has been one of overreaction followed by overreaction to the overreaction. And in the case of the first overreaction, Bush and company responded to 9/11 almost in precisely the wrong way to respond to a terrorist attack, giving the terrorists precisely what they wanted, which was terror, and the kind of overreaction that inflamed the opposition and undercut us through the violation of international law and other subsequent errors. Obama saw this and was ushered into power essentially to be the un-Bush. And for the first 5-6 years of his presidency, I think that was the North Star by which he steered his ship. You know, it was, what would George have done? And then I'm going to do the opposite. And so it was, get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan. Oh, there's a crisis. George would run in. I will run away. And so forth. And of course, not being George Bush, while a good idea perhaps, is not a foreign policy. And so, you know, the reaction to the reaction was flawed. I think in the past year, you're right, Obama's had his most successful year, and I think that's going to continue, because I think not only has he done all the things you've said, and also some smaller things like normalizing relations with Cuba, which here to you may seem ridiculous, because it's ridiculous. You know, this is a policy that was kind of the Edsel of U.S. foreign policy. It actually dates back to the year when the Edsel was actually a car, and failed almost immediately, and the policy failed almost immediately, and it took us 60 years to realize it. But he also has upcoming, I think, a success pending with TPP, because ultimately TPP will happen. And I think he has a success pending that you saw some presaging of today, actually, with regard to the climate talks that will take place in Paris at the end of the year. And Obama, who is essentially inert on climate issues for the first 6 years, has doubled down on those and I think sees that as a potential legacy issue. Now, having said that, you know, I wouldn't go, aha, you know, this is the Goldilocks moment. He's gotten it. Because we still have every country in the Middle East at war, with one exception, which is first time that's happened in the history of the Middle East. Essentially, America's relationship with every single ally that we had in the Middle East is worse today than it was when the Obama administration started, even worse than it was during the last years of the Bush administration. Vladimir Putin is testing the West in Ukraine after having tested it in Georgia, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we saw him test it in the Baltics in the not-too-distant future. He has helped devise a kind of a new approach that is much talked of, hybrid warfare. The layman's definition is define a red line and fight right under it. You know, do everything that you think you can get away with doing that doesn't produce a requirement for strong action, which, by the way, amazingly involves being able to invade a country provided you take the insignia off of your uniform.
And annex it.
And then annex it. And you know, the NATO will go, well, there were no insignia. That's fine. And, you know, that's kind of astounding. You have the Chinese doing the same kind of testing, not just in the South China Sea, but also in cyberspace, where they're joined by the Russians and the Iranians. And right now there is a constant cyber conflict going on, to which the United States and other countries have no deterrent, no doctrine, no policy. And there are a host of other threats in the world that are longer-term threats that we've done precious little to deal with, notably the rise of big powers, notably China's very strategic play for growing influence in Asia, which I don't see as particularly malignant, but I think it is something that needs to be addressed. They have a strategy. We don't have a strategy. And so Obama's doing better. But is he strategic? No, he's still reactive. Does he have a vision? Does he have a plan? No. Is he still defined by his view of American limitations of power rather than what can be done with American power? Yes. And I think those are defects that will define him in the long run.
Let me take you to some of those theatres that you mentioned. Let me start with the Middle East, and you had the striking, you quoted a striking fact. I mean, you can go through the Middle East. I think there's four civil wars currently on in the United States, in the Middle East, I should say, some in the United States as well. You know, countries that are bloodbaths, you've got a non-state actor, the black-flagged armies of the Islamic State on the march. They're a significant force occupying a big chunk of the Arab heartland. We don't know what the flow-on effects from the nuclear deal, presuming that goes ahead. We don't know how the other Gulf states will react to this nuclear dispensation. We don't know how Iran will react. And many people in the region say if this is the trouble that Iran can cause when it's constrained and tied down by sanctions, what will it do when the sanctions fall away? How bad are things in the Middle East in an historical context, and how much of the fault for that should we lay at Obama's feet?
I think things are very bad. I don't think things have been as bad as they are in the Middle East ever. And given the history of the Middle East, that's saying something. I think that the conflicts that we are seeing have a variety of roots, right? You know, the Sykes-Picot period of having foreign spheres of influence and keeping a lid on the region clearly ended in the past few years, and with the pullback of the U.S., with the end of the Cold War, with the EU turning inward, essentially. And so the lid was taken off. A lot of the other stabilizing factors there were the structure of autocracies that never got around to governance, and thus betrayed their people, and uprisings began to occur, and without the support of foreign backers, it was harder for them to keep a lid on things. So that lid was taken off of things. And then technology changed the way power was distributed and used, so that non-state actors, starting with Al-Qaeda, found they could project force in a way that once only states could do, devastating countries far, far away. And ISIS has taken this to the next step. You know, ISIS is kind of the first open architecture terrorist group. You know, they have recognized that the ultimate force multiplier for a terrorist group is being willing to accept anybody with an axe to grind under their banner. And, you know, we've seen it here in Sydney. We see it in the United States, where if you have a lone wolf, they can go to a website, they can embrace ISIS, and all of a sudden, their action becomes something of global consequence, where it wouldn't have been before. And the attack in the Sydney cafe is a perfect example, where a man goes into a cafe with a rifle and an iPad, and the iPad is his weapon. Because using the iPad and videotaping people, it goes onto the internet, and then it gets picked up by the media everywhere, and they start talking about ISIS. And I literally found myself on television in the United States the entire day of that attack, saying to television analysts who were saying, well, this is ISIS, and now they're in Australia, and look at what's going on. I was like, calm down. We don't know. You know, this person could have an agenda. They could have just embraced this at the last minute. The root causes may not be what you think. But there's a genius in their approach, you know, which is that they then get the perception of momentum. And I was in the Pentagon last week. I gave a speech to the Joint Chiefs, and I met with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs afterwards. And one of the things that he said was that they're a little bit concerned right now because ISIS is not having to recruit as much because so many people are signing up, because they're seen as the successful brand, and people want part of that successful brand. And so you've got that also churning in this. On top of that, you've got Iran, which for 30 years has been trying to extend its influence throughout the region, and all of a sudden they're on the verge of a $150 billion windfall. And having the P5 plus one countries, the countries that negotiated the deal, having a stake in Iran's growing success. So they're gaining while the other countries are losing. And that makes the people in those countries nervous. And in places like Saudi Arabia, They feel surrounded because there's Iran and Syria, Iran and Iraq, Iran or Iranian sympathizers in Yemen. All of this creates a kind of a tension that we've never seen before. And I don't know how the Iran deal is going to play out. You know, my personal view is it's not a perfect deal. It essentially kicks the can down the road in terms of Iranian nuclear weapons program for 10 to 15 years. But it's better than having an Iranian nuclear weapons program now. And so we might as, and the deal is going to happen. So we might as well be focused on how do you make the deal work as opposed to opposing it. But having said that, it does give them this windfall. It does give them the chance to compound the inroads they've made elsewhere in the region and take advantage of the weakness of the Sunni states at the moment, who don't have similarly the wind at their back. In fact, Iran's going to come onto the market with a lot of oil. Oil prices are going to fall further, and that's going to squeeze those Sunni states even more. You look at this and you look at, you know, the humanitarian crisis in Syria, and you look at some of the things that have yet to happen. There'll be a flare-up in Libya later this year that's going to be terrible. There are further kinds of conflicts that we can expect in Afghanistan, for example, as the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan. And you say, oh, my God, that Obama is really terrible as a foreign policy president. Well, he gets, for everything but the Iran deal, he gets 0 points. I mean, how he handled Syria, how he handled Iraq, how he's handled Afghanistan, how he's handled Yemen, how he's handled Libya, how he's handled our allies, how he's handled the U.S.-Israel relationship, how he's handled the relationship in the Gulf, lousy. Not strategic, said he would do things, then he didn't do them. No kind of long-term vision, not really working well with the allies. A better record on the Iran deal, but that's just a piece of the puzzle. It's not a solution in and of itself. But he's not responsible for the fact that Sykes-Picot hit 100 years old and expired, or for the end of the Cold War, or for the fact that the Sunni states have not governed their people very well, or for the fact that technology has empowered non-state actors in the way that they've done. And so you can't sort of say, well, this is all Obama's fault. And by the way, George W. Bush destabilized the region enormously when he took our primary counterbalance against Iran, which was Iraq, and essentially laid waste to it. So George W. Bush bears a lot of responsibility for this, but so do the Sunni leaders, so do the Iranians, so do the Israelis, so does Hezbollah, so does Hamas. And frankly, from my point of view, the biggest factor here is that this is a part of the world that is in the headlines today, not because it is more relevant, but because it is actually in the death throes of a struggle because their societies are not adapting to modernizing in the way the rest of the world does. And as a result, they're in the headlines because they are becoming more irrelevant, not because they're becoming more relevant. And I think that's the big underlying issue that has to be addressed. If you want to stabilize the region, we've got to find a formula for those societies to create opportunity for the people within them organically, or this is just going to be a cauldron of discontent for decades to come.
Well, let me bring you to a theater that is becoming more and more relevant, and that is our own region of Asia and the Pacific. And compared to the bleakness of the Middle East and the brittleness of Europe, if you like, things look pretty bright in Asia. You've had strong economic growth.
You don't have
growth.
A lot of money in the Chinese stock market at the moment.
Well, luckily, neither do many Chinese people.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, China, for all its flaws, the Chinese Communist Party have pulled 700 or 800 million people out of poverty. You've seen one Asian country after another rise and succeed under the aegis of American primacy in the region. Does Obama have a claim to a better policy in Asia. He has the rebalance, about which we've heard a lot. How seriously do you take the rebalance? Is it a significant policy initiative that will continue to inform US foreign policy in the coming decades, or is this an initiative that will die at the next election?
Well, first of all, I think the rebalance has died. The rebalance was a first term of the Obama administration initiative that was really driven by a handful of people, notably Hillary Clinton, but also to some extent the National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, and a kind of a large coterie of China specialists who happened to make their way up to the top in the government. They're all gone. And the people who have replaced them are not that interested in Asia. You have not seen as much activity in Asia since then. I think that as an Obama initiative, you've seen it sort of wither on the vine. But what drives the situation in the Asia-Pacific region is much akin to what's driving the situation in the Middle East, which is historical trends, long-term historical trends. The reason the pivot takes place is not because of a president. It's because this is the center of economic gravity in the world, and it is only going to grow more important. And the center of economic gravity typically goes with the center of political gravity, and also, by the way, the center of intellectual gravity. You sort of see the big ideas of the world throughout history coming from the region closest to the center of economic and political gravity. So Europe, then for a while the US, and I think increasingly from Asia. And I think that's extremely relevant in the context of your question, because you look at China and you say, well, that's not a democracy. They're not following the American playbook, but they have been growing for four decades, and they have lifted 700 or 800 million people out of poverty. You say, well, what does that mean? Well, maybe authoritarian governments with a bigger focus on governance can get a little bit further. It's a cousin of the Singaporean approach, and it's a cousin of certain other approaches. But I think it's even more interesting in the context of the future of the economy, because the future of the economy is the digital economy. And we are right now at a pivotal moment in the world where we have cyber internationalist countries, kind of the US, Australia, the European countries, where we sort of look at the internet and say this will open up borders and connect people, versus cyber nationalist countries that look at the internet and say, we control the internet like we would control any other domain within our borders. And there is a tension there. And we in the United States, because we're narcissistic, tend to believe everything will ultimately go the way that we want it to go. And that's also because over the course of the past 100 years, that's happened a lot. I'm not sure that's what's going to happen here. I think that the cyber nationalist view, which is primarily championed by the Chinese, which says we're going to control the internet within our borders, we're going to set the rules, we are going to intrude on privacy where we need to do it, national security is going to prevail, and so forth. Well, I think they're winning a lot of adherence, and it's not just Russia and repressive states. It's places like the Gulf states and places like India, and even Brazil has embraced this to some extent, because a lot of states are very uncomfortable with the fact that the internet is undermining their national power, right? And so I think this rise of China and rise of the region has a lot of consequences we haven't thought about, and that makes the withdrawal from focus on this region of the pivot problematic. And then the last point I'd make is the Chinese have a strategy. When I go around Southeast Asia and I talk to Southeast Asian leaders, they'll go, well, the Chinese were just here. And they'll say, you want a road, we'll build a road. You want a port, we'll build a port. We want an airport, we'll build an airport. We want to create interdependence. And the Chinese have the One Belt, One Road approach, where they've got a strategy of building their influence around through the Straits of Malacca and off into the Indian Ocean and into the Middle East and then onto Europe. And the road across Central Asia and into Pakistan and then across into the Middle East and on into Europe. You might say, well, that's a paper, it's a theory, it's abstract, but it's not. They're actually doing it. The biggest Chinese embassy in the world is in Pakistan. They just did a trade mission there where they invested $46 billion. They're building a railroad from Pakistan to China. They're building a highway from Pakistan to China. They're active in Central Asia. The United States doesn't know where Central Asia is. We don't have anybody who's aware and thinking of Central Asia. We're essentially ceding the relationship that we've had with Pakistan because it's become so toxic. And we're not paying attention to what's going on here. You know, 3 weeks ago, you may have seen an article that said that the Taliban are going to begin conversations with the Afghan government. And you probably thought, well, okay, that was inevitable. That was going to happen. The U.S. wants out. We'll take any deal we can get. But if you went to the fourth paragraph and it said the talks are going to take place in Pakistan, the observers to the talks that were agreed to by the Taliban, the Pakistanis, the Afghans, was the U.S. and China. What is China doing playing a mediating role with regard to Afghanistan? They played, for the first time in history on this Iran deal, a central role in an issue of the Middle East. So they've got a strategy, and aside from a little sort of kissy face with, you know, Modi and India, and a little, you know, we're changing our policy with regard to Myanmar, despite all the lousy things that the government in Myanmar is doing, and a couple thousand troops in Darwin, Australia, we don't have a counter-strategy for this. That's going to prove to be perhaps a bigger black mark on the Obama administration legacy than even what's going on in the Middle East and in Ukraine.
Well, let me dig a bit deeper into the United States and Asia. You've said that the United States doesn't have a strategy in Asia. You were saying to me earlier that there's not that much activity in Washington on Asia, in the think tanks, in Congress. We know the media is not particularly focused on Asia. We know that U.S. policymakers remain drawn to the Middle East like iron filings to a magnet. But you've also said today that history is driven by long-term trends and the shift in the polarities and the shift in the weights. And we know the weights are moving to Asia. So does that mean that inevitably, even though Washington is not focused on Asia at the moment, inevitably, just through the force of gravity, really, eventually America will pivot to Asia, even if it's not as a result of a first-term Obama policy?
Absolutely. I mean, look, American companies are pivoting to Asia. American people are pivoting to Asia. The amount of trade that goes across the Pacific grows. The amount of trade that's contained within the TPP countries grows. The future of the region of the Western Hemisphere is defined more by Asia. China's the leading investor in Latin America, the leading trading partner of many of the countries in Latin America. The fast-growing countries in Latin America are countries that have tied up with the Chinese. And the Chinese are, you know, I mean, Brazil, strangely enough, after all this time when it had its moment, which may be ending, but when it had its moment for the past few years, did so as kind of the breadbasket of China, you know, producing, wheat and corn and things that were sold into this market and all of Latin America commodities sold into this market. And so I think that's only going to grow, and I think it'll grow further as China becomes more central to issues like the Middle East. You know, when the Iran deal happens, the Iranians are going to start selling oil. Well, who's going to buy the oil? Well, it's going to be bought by the Chinese and the Indians more than anybody else. So all of a sudden, it's going to pull the focus of the Middle East much more to Asia. In fact, I wrote something a while back that said that, you know, we talked about pivoting to Asia and away from the Middle East. We didn't actually do it, but the Middle East pivoted away from us to Asia in the meantime. And, you know, China is the number one trading partner of Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's the number two trading partner of Israel and Pakistan. So something big is happening in terms of all of that. That's going to drive us. I actually have an article that's going up on foreign policy in the morning.
Is it about Goldilocks and the three bears?
No, I've stole that from you before. And, but stay tuned to foreign policy for other ideas I steal from Michael in the future. It's talking about sort of the breaking down of the traditional alliances that we've had in the world, and the need to rethink those and revitalize them, because many of the alliances that the U.S. has, which have been a big strategic asset, date back to World War II and have all sort of reached retirement age, and you know they need to be rethought. And the question is, who's going to do that? And that hasn't happened yet. Well, one of the other things that I've been thinking about in the past couple of months is that the strategic relationships that were central to those alliances, the special relationships, have also deteriorated. You know, for most of American history, the special relationship was with the United Kingdom. But the United Kingdom's in the middle of drawing down its military to the point where there will be fewer people in the British military than there are in the British Army, than there are in the New York City Police Department. It's going to go down below 50,000. The UK, of course, faces the prospect with the wind of the Scottish National Party of not holding together in the way that it did. It's much less relevant in Europe. The UK used to be our most important European partner. It's now number three, and it's lagging number two by a lot because France and Germany are much, much more important than the United States in the European context going forward. Israel used to be a special relationship that was extremely important, but for generational issues and because of the way the Israelis have behaved and because of American oil and the end of the Cold War and a whole bunch of other things, it's less important. So in this new world, who are the special relationships? And one of the things that I say in this article, I say one has got to be India, fourth largest navy in the world, some kind of cultural affinities, the biggest democracy in the world, the primary counterbalance to China strategically. And I don't just say this to pander to this audience, although I've never met an audience I didn't want to pander to in some respect. But the other special relationship for the 21st century I talk about is Australia. And I really think, you know, and we may all look at it as a kind of an irony in 75 years, but I really think that it's quite possible that 75 years from now the U.S.-Australia relationship is dramatically more important than the U.S.-UK relationship. Because of the shift of focus to this region, because of the natural affinities between the countries, because of Australia's role in providing critical resources to this region, because of its strategic role, and so forth. And so I think one of the things you look at is new alliances, but the other thing you have to look at is new special relationships.
Well, there's no better way to pander to an Australian audience than to say we're better than the Brits, so well done. I have lots of other questions, but I want to give the audience an opportunity to ask David some questions. So please, if you'd like to ask David a question, put your hand up. We have a microphone. Down the front, please just limit it to a question rather than a comment and identify yourself first, if you would, sir.
Yeah, John Dobies. In terms of Iran, what if they just signed no agreement and they just kept going as they were with the sanctions?
What if? What would happen then?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that's possible, because obviously sanctions must be maintained, and I don't know that the Europeans have the will to maintain the sanctions, or the Russians have the will to maintain the sanctions, or the Chinese have the will to maintain the sanctions. And if the Iranians showed a strong interest in not pursuing their program in exchange for not having sanctions, and the U.S. said, we're not going along with it, I think the rest of the world would go along with it. So I don't know that the regime could hold. And clearly, you know, unilateral sanctions, even though we admire the strength of our financial sanctions, for example, as being especially painful for other countries, unilateral sanctions don't work. And so I think the Iranians would benefit from that. You know, I think had the United States said, we're not going to set artificial deadlines, we want to pursue anytime, anywhere inspections, or we're not going to go and give in on the end of the arms sanctions or the end of the ICBM sanctions, it's just not going to be part of it, we'll negotiate for another year, you might have been able to maintain things for another year and gotten an incrementally better deal. But I don't think there was an indefinite period of time to play with on that.
I'll call Hugh Powell in the second row. Hugh was the Deputy National Security Advisor to Prime Minister Cameron, so he may have a question on special relationships or indeed some other topic. Hugh.
No, it was a very simple question. I just wanted to take you back to what I think Michael's opening question was, which is, so what exactly should the next US president do differently? You've sort of thrown out a lot of mud. But you haven't boiled it down to some specifics.
Did you say I've thrown out a lot of mud?
Yeah, I mean, criticism of almost every aspect of U.S. foreign policy across the board. But what is it that it is realistic for the next U.S. president to do? I mean, are you essentially saying he or she should use more force, use force differently? Are you saying that somehow the U.S. government should find a way to, you know, spend money on international infrastructure to compete with China? You know, what are the specifics that the next president needs to do differently?
Well, I think you're off to a pretty good start there. The levels on which we can improve on what we've done are manifold. I think we need to think about what America's role in the world is and what the role of our allies in the world ought to be and what our interests are going forward and what we're willing to do to advance those interests. But in terms of the specifics that we can do better, I think that we need to rethink and revitalize the international alliances we've got because they have not been functioning extremely well. I think we do need to follow through on the pivot to Asia and the prioritizing of the issues in this region in a way that we haven't done before. And I think that we need to undertake to rebuild alliances in a way that help produce more stability in places like the Middle East. So, for example, I think critical to the success of the Iran deal is the reestablishment of traditional ties to forces that were counterbalanced the Iranians. And you have this kind of strange confluence that the Israelis, as well as the Gulf states and the Egyptians, all have an interest in counterbalancing the Iranians. I think we need to work with them in a way that we have not done and that selling them a few fighter aircraft does not do, in finding a new positive agenda for them. And frankly, I would focus that agenda on the fact that over the course of the next 10 years in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Libya, we are going to have the responsibility of rebuilding, or the world is going to have the challenge of dealing with the need for rebuilding in those countries. And if you don't, you're going to have the spread of violent extremism. And I think the spread of violent extremism, the only way to counter it in those places is to find the money to help rebuild those places. That's going to require a global alliance. I think in the course of the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to face a very serious problem in the context of Europe, where you have simultaneously situation in the Middle East producing flows of refugees into Europe that will be taken advantage of by nationalist parties in the southern part of Europe particularly, who don't like those refugees. And you could have the rise of the right and the rise of nationalism in Europe. And strangely, many of those parties have been courted by Mr. Putin. And therefore, you could have a shifting balance within Europe that needs to be counteracted. And I think that requires the revitalization of the Atlantic Alliance. We have TPP coming. I think TTIP and the Transatlantic Trade Partnership is a critical way to do that. But I think we have to go further. I think our response to Putin with regard to Ukraine was anemic. I don't think the little dog and pony shows we've got currently running, where we take little convoys of troops from one country to another and sort of pretend that we're engaged, is enough. I think it's going to require some redeployment and some rethinking of the next generation threats. I think we need to have a strategy for dealing with emerging cyber threats and essentially the digitalization of the planet, where I think we have major, major changes on the horizon that are going to change the nature of governance and identity and human rights and how economies work and so forth, that we haven't been dealing with because we've been dealing with these crises. And the next president is going to have to develop a capacity to understand and deal with those things in a way that he hasn't done. I think that we've neglected the Americas altogether. We don't have any sort of policy in Latin America. And I think we are being essentially edged out of our own neighborhood by countries like China, which are trading more there. And I think we can do more to engage in that regard. I think in all of these things, the distinction is not do you do 180 degrees the opposite of Barack Obama or 180 degrees the opposite of George W. Bush. I think the objective is to find strategies that are incrementally stronger and more effective and to pursue them. And this is, you know, this is essentially the kind of situation we've had a kind of false argument for the course of the past several years, where, you know, on the course of the Iran deal, we'll say, well, either you have the deal or you have a war, you know, and that's not it. You could have 6 months more of negotiation and you could have a somewhat better deal. In Syria, it's like, well, what do you want us to do? Go in and do an Iraq and Syria? Well, no, we should never go in and do an Iraq anyplace else. But could we have gotten our act together and stood up and pushed out Assad earlier, or gone and set up no-fly zones and humanitarian corridors so you didn't push 4 or 6 million people out of the country, and avoided the humanitarian catastrophe and nipped in the bud the rise of groups like ISIS? Could you have left 20,000 troops on the ground in Iraq or 20,000 troops on the ground in Afghanistan so that you would keep a lid on the problem instead of leaving altogether too quickly? And I think in case after case after case, in Ukraine, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, with regard to the pivot of China, with regard to our Latin America policy, with regard to our trade policy, with regard to our alliance policy, I think incrementally we could be a little more forward-leaning and a little bit more future thinking and be better off than we have been. And so that's what I think the job is for the next president.
The character of the U.S., of the foreign policy that will be prosecuted by the next president will depend on the character of the person who's elected. So talk to us a little bit about the condition of the race at this stage. Should our U.S. allies be worried about the prospect of a President Trump? Should, you know, we presume that on the Democratic side, the Clinton steamroller will knock any other candidates foolish enough to run out of the way. On the Republican side, we don't know. It's so hard to tell. There are so many characters there. So who do you think might emerge on the Republican side if you're a betting man? What sort of foreign policy might a Republican candidate deliver? How might that differ from a Hillary Clinton foreign policy?
Well, first of all, one of the reasons that I'm down here is just doing a little recon in case Trump actually wins. Because I'm thinking of moving my family down here and getting as far away from the United States as possible. Not because I think of him just primarily as a threat to the U.S., although he is certainly that, but I think of him as a giant embarrassment for the United States. Inside Washington, people are less embarrassed than they should be, partially because they have plenty to be embarrassed about on their own, but in part because they know that this is silly season in American politics, and that these months, you know, in the summer, before the fall, before the real primaries take place, there is always somebody, you know, if you believed what happened, you know, in the summer of 2007, you would have President Michelle Bachmann in the United States, or you would have had President Hillary Clinton, for that matter. You know, I mean, it's just we get it wrong this early, typically. I think on the Democratic side, there's every reason to expect that Hillary Clinton would be the candidate, and I think Hillary Clinton would be an extremely capable candidate. Would have more experience on foreign policy than all but one of the last six presidents of the United States, the exception being George H.W. Bush, has a lot of experience executive level, is politically quite gifted, despite what a lot of people say, but in terms of the inside politics of Washington, she's extremely good at that, and she has a very good, solid, capable team around her. Having said that, it's a little early to count chickens on that front. You know, there's rumors this week that Vice President Biden is considering running. Vice President Biden has been considering running since he was 8 years old, I think. He's 71, so, I mean, that's 63 years of planning for this. He's not going to give up, and if you think his appetite is great, you know, John Kerry's appetite is greater, and believe me, you know, the Nobel Prize arrives on John Kerry's desk, and Hillary Clinton looks a little bit weak. You're going to see a somewhat more complicated field, I'm guessing. Could she look weak? Well, this thing with the emails, the thing with the Clinton Global Initiative and so forth, you know, it will get picked at and picked at and picked at by her opponents, and you just never know what's going to come up. The Clinton Global Initiative had 300,000 donors. 100,000 of those donors are foreign donors. You don't know who those people are, but, you know, there could be a bunch of ugly stories in there. There were 55,000 emails. Well, we've just looked at 50 of them and we found four things. Now, I was in the Clinton administration. I think Hillary Clinton would be a terrific president. But as an objective analyst of all of this, I think you have to look at it and say, those are factors that could change this thing fairly dramatically. On the Republican side, you have 16 candidates, most of whom, you know, you won't hear of again after December. But Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Scott Walker, maybe Rand Paul, somebody else will survive out into this. Maybe Donald Trump will survive for a while into this thing, because they're going to give him a lot of birth. And the reason they're going to give him a lot of birth is if Donald Trump decided to run as a third-party candidate, which he could easily afford out of his, you know, petty cash, he will defeat the Republicans. We've seen this movie before. That's what Ross Perot did in 1992. And if he just takes 4, 5, 6, 8% in a race where it's going to come down to 4 or 5%, he could decide this thing. And so the Republicans do, you know, I mean, you know, here is a guy who in the course of a week or two said that Mexicans were rapists and criminals, and then had a close aide of his say that, you know, rape could not occur within marriage, and that, you know, all the assertions that Trump did nasty things to his wife should be dismissed, which would have killed any other candidate. I mean, it's appalling. But he hasn't been killed because he has this sort of gun to the head of the Republican Party, which is, I can run on my own. And they know that, and they're a little bit afraid. But I think, you know, the Republican Party tends to be small C conservative as well as big C conservative. They tend to pick the candidate who seems to be next in line, the most mainstream candidate. There's a lot of hand-waving about right-wingers, and then you end up with somebody more moderate, like Jeb Bush or like Marco Rubio, like Scott Walker. A very prominent Republican who's a friend of mine said to me, Scott, he thought Scott Walker was going to win. This is the governor of Wisconsin. And at the same breath, he said, now, of course, Scott Walker is not the kind of guy you would have studied off of for your high school physics test, meaning not notably bright. But we've had dumb presidents before. Pick your favorite. But, you know, you may have had this experience yourselves. But I think more likely is Jeb Bush, because he's got lots and lots of money, and he's got the establishment behind him, and the sort of fratricide among the other candidates is likely to leave him standing longer. And you know, he could be attacked for being a Bush by anybody except Hillary Clinton. If you have one dynasty running against the other, they afford each other cover. And I think, you know, it comes down to your Goldilocks analogy, and it comes down to my prescription for what a U.S. president's got to do better. My guess is, and don't tell anybody, but my guess is that the Democratic candidate, whoever that is, probably Hillary Clinton, the Republican candidate, whoever that is, probably somebody like Jeb Bush, will have a foreign policy that's much more similar to each other than they would like to admit. And that they would also share as an attribute that they are running against, gingerly, the foreign policies of both George Bush and Barack Obama. You know, in other words, they're going to go and they're going to hew towards the middle and hew towards a little bit more traditional, a little bit more forward-leaning, a little bit more forceful approach on the part of the U.S.
And just to pull you out on that, which of their foreign policies do you think would be more interested in, more focused on Asia? Because often Australian foreign policy analysts say that Republican presidents are better on Asia, that Democrats are more focused on Europe, that Republicans tend to be less ideological, more commercially minded, better on Asia. But of course, as you mentioned, Hillary also has a cadre of Asia experts who are with whom she's pretty tight and who may indeed occupy high positions under a Clinton administration. Do you think, would there be a difference on Asia policy, do you think, between, say, a Jeb Bush administration and a Hillary administration?
I'm sure there would be differences, but I think both of them will place Asia higher up the list of priorities than the Obama administration did in the second term, for just the reasons that you said. And for the reason that Asia will be of more importance. Hillary Clinton will be more inclined to take human rights issues and place them up the top of foreign policy priorities, as she has done in the past with the Chinese in ways that have made the Chinese uncomfortable. And I think, you know, you're likely to find the same thing in Myanmar with the Rohingya or wherever else you might see this kind of thing. I think Jeb Bush is more likely to place commercial issues higher up the list of priorities, and argue that he would be tough. The interesting thing, though, is that Hillary Clinton was kind of one of the hawks in the early Obama administration. And I think on issues like China and the South China Sea, she would be fairly fairly tough as well. It'll be interesting to see how both deal with the militarization of Japan. It'll be interesting to see how both deal with what might be potential tumult in North Korea, and how that all turns out, because I don't think that turns out the way the Americans ultimately want it to turn out. I think that whomever wins, you're going to see Asia being more central.
I might take one more question because we started a little bit late. Is there anybody who'd like to ask the final question of David Rothkopf?
I've talked you into stupefaction.
Yes, Aaron Connolly.
Thanks, Michael. I wanted to ask you on that same theme about the American narrative in East Asia in particular, but perhaps also some of the other regions you're very familiar with. You know, I think the United States has a pretty good narrative when it comes to the international order, talking about rules and the need for countries to obey those rules, even if they want to revise those rules, and, you know, we can have a conversation about that. But when China and Russia go to, say, the illiberal democracies of Southeast Asia or some of the countries in the Middle East, and say, we have a non-judgmental foreign policy. We don't put out a report every year assessing how well you treat your citizens by our own standards. That seems to resonate in those regions. So how do we reconcile that narrative where we seem to be winning on those international order arguments, but we don't seem to be winning anymore on issues like human rights?
Candidly, I think the rise of China is going to make it harder. Because I think China has had considerable amount of success being a non-judgmental partner on those issues. And I think China's influence is going to grow as a consequence of that success. And, you know, I think you've seen the U.S. Take a step back from the centrality of human rights that it periodically takes place, for example, during the Carter administration, and some other periods in U.S. history, and flared up a little bit when I was in the government during the Clinton administration. And you know, there are examples everywhere. Look at Egypt right now, where you have Kerry saying, well, we need Egypt. Egypt is a foundation of counterbalancing Iran and trying to provide stability in this part of the world. And even though the Sisi government's doing a lot of tough things, We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We've got to be able to have a good relationship where we can and put pressure where we can. And I think, you know, that's going to be the standard more and more. And I think an irony, or perhaps a cause for all of this is related to the relationship with China, where we need China. You know, this is not the new Cold War. You know, the China is not the equivalent of Russia. You know, that was a zero-sum game. They lost, we gained. You know, but with China, we are interdependent. We are these two giants that are attached like Siamese twins in a lot of our vital organs, and we just can't pull apart from them. And so we have to find a way to cultivate our common interests, and yet at the same time maintain a dialogue about our differences. I think that's maturity in a relationship, frankly. I just hope that we are able, when those vital interests include drawing red lines around humanitarian catastrophe or abuses or setting rules for the international system that might later prove to be extremely costly, that we'll have the resolve to hold our own.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've had a terrific discussion today that has spanned from China's rise to Islamic State as the first open architecture terrorist organisation, a very nice phrase which I might plagiarise, David. It only seems fair.
Yeah, you're right. I owe you at least one.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me urge you to read fp.com every day, as I do, to read all the terrific work by David and his colleagues, especially tomorrow when he's going to write about Australia as the new special relationship. And please join me in thanking David Rothkopf.